Homelessness, like everything else, is bigger in Texas. And so down in Austin, a private organization called Mobile Loaves and Fishes has created an RV and tiny home village that will soon encompass 51 acres and will house about one-third of Austin's homeless. It was put together by Alan Graham, and I asked him to explain this village. He calls it the Community First Village. Asked him to explain what this is like with hundreds of homeless people living in one place.
Yeah, brought them together in one place. It's in a place that has a outdoor Alamo Drafthouse movie theater, one of the most successful bed and breakfasts in the United States of America.
Really?
Yes. Full-blown organic farm. We have a car care business on site.
There's a place people can actually work and make money?
That's correct. In fact, in the past 2 years alone, we will have distributed over $1 million in dignified income to men and women that are working here on site.
Wow. So what do you do about bathrooms and kitchens?
We have laundry, restroom, shower facilities, outdoor kitchens. It's a phenomenal place. I live here.
You live there?
I live here.
You're not just visiting. You're living there. You'll sleep there tonight.
I will sleep here tonight with my beautiful wife of nearly 35 years. And in fact, there are 50 other people, including some of the most successful entrepreneurs in Austin, Texas, that live in this community.
That sounds crazy to me. It sounds like, by all accounts, that this has been a success. You have people who are making their own way. As you point out, they've got jobs, they have responsibilities, and they're rewarded for that. What is it that keeps it successful? What's your secret? Because the problem that we have had with some of these villages is that sometimes there's political infighting. Sometimes you have people who just can't get along. What is your secret?
Well, the secret is that all of these other developments, and not being there in Seattle, I can't speak specifically, but generally, are transactional models. It's built on the premise that we can solve homelessness by getting people into houses. And our model says that housing will never solve homelessness, but community will. It's a relational model. It requires people in the community to embed themselves in the lives of men and women who have found themselves stranded on our street corners. And it's understanding why are they on those street corners. And we believe very profoundly that the single greatest cause is a profound, catastrophic loss of family. It's not drug addictions or mental health issues. Mm-hmm. Heck, if you start telling me what's going on in your family, I'm going to find somebody that's battling mental health issues. And you got an addict, brother, mother, father, aunt, uncle, somebody in your household. And everybody that's listening has got that in their family. And somehow we managed to come up underneath that and keep those family members from drifting out onto the streets.
So you solved the community problem. Now, that must mean that there are some people who don't. I mean, you have to be selective in some way, don't you?
Not overly selective. The barriers to get in here are extraordinarily low. You could be an active addict, an active alcoholic. You can have every criminal record on the planet with the exception right now of being a registered sex offender. So the barriers are extraordinarily low. It's really all about recognizing the dignity of the human person and then putting them into an environment where there's some values that the community wants to adhere to. Mm-hmm. So we have three fundamental rules here. Rule number one, above all other rules, is you must pay rent. Rule number two is you must be obedient to civil law. I don't make civil law, and I don't enforce civil law. So what you're doing inside the privacy of your own home is your business. But if there's negative collateral damage to your behavior that spills into the community, that's when we're going to get involved. And then the third rule is that like a homeowners association or a condominium association, we have some simple rules. You know, if you have a dog and your dog poos in the yard, you're going to have to bend over and pick up the poo. And so it's simple community rules like that that actually inspire people into a freedom lifestyle.
The frustration here in Seattle, Alan, is that we've been declaring homeless emergencies, and we still have this problem with some pretty rough-looking tent encampments along the highways. And and we try a lot of solutions, but nothing seems to get rid of those tents. You have come up with something that that actually works, and yet you still can't get rid of all the tents. Is that correct?
Well, look, it's going to take time. It takes a lot of money to do what we're doing. We raise all of our money privately. You're not going to be able to mitigate this through government funding. There is a limit to the government's ability to fund everything on the face of the planet. The community's got to jump in and get involved. They have to quit abdicating to city hall, state government, Washington, D.C. And what we're facing right now, brother, is three generations in the making, and we're not going to be able to get out of this in 5 or 10 years. And so everybody's looking for the aha moment right now, as opposed to coming up with smart ideas like what we're doing here in Austin, Texas at Community First Village, and then blocking and tackling and buttoning and singling our way to mitigate this calamity.
Okay, so you're at 27 acres of tiny homes and RVs now, and you're going to double that. Does this just keep expanding and expanding, or over time, do people get on their feet and move up into something better?
I think that unless we begin to recognize why this is happening, and we believe a profound catastrophic loss of family, so unless we as an American culture go all the way upstream and begin to rebuild our family values here in the United States, and I'm not trying to define what that looks like, but I'm talking about people growing up in loving, caring, nurturing, formative family environments. Until we recognize that deal, this deal is not going to end.
I would agree. A healthy family solves pretty much every problem society has. Is it really, let me ask you this, is it really worse than it was, or is it just getting more publicity now?
No, I actually think that it's worse than it's ever been. I mean, I moved to Austin, Texas in 1976 to go to the university here, and there were no panhandlers. I mean, there were a few homeless people, the stereotypical homeless people. There were no panhandlers standing on the street corners. We had men and women working all over the place, selling bottles of water and newspapers and flowers and cow skins and cow skulls and velvet Elvis art on street corners. And, you know, we've outlawed all that. And then there's just been this influx of people pouring onto the streets. And the government can only try to fix it with money. So programs like Head Start, which I agree with, is merely providing the economics of providing food to people, but it doesn't go into the household and provide a loving, nurturing relationship to the children that are growing up in poverty. Yes, we're getting them food, which we need to do. Look, there's two things about you and I that are intrinsic from the moment we were created. You and I both desire to be fully and wholly loved, and we desire to be fully and wholly known. It's that simple. It's not complex, man. And if we keep pushing people to the furthest fringes of society, we're going to continue to reap the reward of that particular behavior.
Alan Graham, founder of Mobile Loaves and Fishes, who's established a homeless community so successful that he himself lives there.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. There is a fairly scary story in USA Today pointing out that deaths due to alcohol far outnumbered deaths due to opioids, and yet we are not issuing any stronger warnings on alcohol. Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. The numbers here are truly frightening. And the thing that surprised me, Dr. Cohen, is that they count as deaths due to alcohol things like coronary heart disease, cancer. I guess saying that the alcohol exacerbates these things, is that a good way to go about categorizing the data?
Yeah, good morning, Dave. So this story came out of a study that actually was published by the University of Washington, and it was published in Lancet, which is one of the leading medical journals in the world, to be honest with you. And they reviewed basically the worldwide literature and looked at the impact of alcohol consumption and what would be a tolerable level and how was it associated with or related to death. And they concluded that there are nearly 3 million deaths globally that are attributed to alcohol use. And 12% of all deaths in males between the ages of 15 and 49 were as a result of alcohol consumption. Now, the thing is, your question is a good one, because when we think of people dying of alcohol use, is it the acute overdose of alcohol or is it the chronic use of alcohol? It's true, as you mentioned in your intro, that alcohol use kills more than opioids. In fact, there were about 72,000 opioid overdoses last year, whereas there were 88,000 associated with overconsumption of alcohol acutely. We don't address this in the same kind of way because it's culturally more acceptable to drink alcohol than it is to use opioids. We don't look at people and say, oh, it's okay to go out and shoot up heroin, but we do say it's okay to consume alcohol.
Right. I mean, you can look at bars as safe injection sites for alcohol, right?
Yeah, exactly. The thing is what we don't think about when we talk about overconsumption of alcohol is death from other sources. So it turns out that there are a lot of cancers that are related to alcohol use. Cirrhosis of the liver is related to alcohol use, pancreatitis, and in fact, suicide and a number of other diseases are related to alcohol
use. So those are all counted in the study then?
They are. In fact, they looked at cardiovascular disease, hemorrhagic strokes and ischemic strokes, hypertensive heart disease, and so forth. And they looked at cancers, from breast cancer to cancers of the GI tract, other non-communicable diseases, like I already mentioned, cirrhosis, and other things like diabetes, epilepsy, and pancreatitis, and so forth. And they looked at the role that alcohol plays in communicable diseases, like respiratory infections and tuberculosis. And then there's the intentional injuries, the ones that we typically think of associated with alcohol use, which are interpersonal violence or self-harm. And then unintentional injuries, also the things we usually think about, drownings or motor vehicle accidents or things like that. So they looked at all these different categories.
Well, clearly the thrust of the article is that we should be treating alcohol misuse with the same kind of intensity as we're doing with the opioids now.
Yeah, it's interesting. The editor of The Lancet actually came out with a very, very strong statement basically saying this is a global problem and it requires immediate attention and that basically there should be zero tolerance for consumption of alcohol. Now, that's probably an unreasonable thing at this point in time. I don't think we're going to go back to the prohibition era. And even when we did that, people continued to drink alcohol. So that's not really a reasonable approach to take. But I think the point is, and that they were trying to get across, is that really different than what we've talked about before is they're saying that there is no safe limit for alcohol use, that in fact, alcohol is a poison. It poisons our body and it causes all these problems. And
we're including wine here. So all that stuff about resveratrol and
exactly.
Just throw that out the window. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. They didn't differentiate between beer, wine or spirits because they felt that it was the alcohol in it that was causing the problems.
So this study is saying don't drink, period.
I mean, there are other studies that have been published looking at kind of related things. For example, there's been an increase in the number of binge drinking episodes seen in emergency rooms, which is, of course, the most expensive place to get treated. In states where they have more stringent control of alcohol consumption, so they have alcohol control policies, they have a lower incidence of binge drinking.
Should we have This is very frustrating because I thought they should have kept the state-run liquor store systems. The stores were sparse, overpriced. I mean, the people were friendly enough, but it was kind of inconvenient to buy booze. And now, of course, it's easy to buy booze.
Well, you're making exactly the points that were made during the time that initiative ended up on the ballot. And in fact, you're correct. And I think that's been well demonstrated in this country. The states that have the most stringent alcohol control policies, those are the states where they have the lowest incidence of binge drinking and the lowest incidence of chronic alcohol use. But in the end, I think as a recommendation, there's a lot of other studies out there that should not be ignored. I don't think that there is any one study that should change everything that we do in society. This just has to be taken alongside all the other data that's been published in leading medical journals throughout the world over the decades. And again, I'm going to make the recommendation I always do is consume things in moderation. Do what you can handle. Don't do anything dangerous. Just be safe.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan, and here's Hannah Scott. The Me Too movement has caught the ear of the State Human Rights Commission, and they're going to take some action. So, Hannah, tell us what they're discussing.
The State Human Rights, well, several bills were passed in the legislature earlier this year in the wake of the Me Too movement. One of them required the State Human Rights Commission to form a work group to come up with best practices to prevent sexual harassment in the workplace. So they have been meeting over the last several months with a variety of people, human resources heads, survivor advocates, employers, workers, and various industry groups to get some information and see what everybody thinks are the best policies. They initial recommendations, the first draft, I should say, of the initial recommendations are now out. And the Laura Lindstrom with the State Human Rights Commission gave the Senate panel an update on those recommendations last week. They include things like making sure your company has an open door policy and making that clear, making sure that you are clearly stating that sexual harassment won't be tolerated and have the resources to back it up. And if you're not getting sexual harassment complaints at your company, don't think everything is fine. It may just be that your policy is weak, according to them. Republican Senator Linda Wilson, who's a small business owner, had some issues with that one.
This kind of makes my blood boil because you're telling me that because I don't have this in my workplace that I'm doing something wrong.
Actually, I think the language does not say that. The language suggests that just because you don't have complaints, it doesn't mean that there's not a problem. It's not saying that there is definitely a problem.
So, but that type of feedback is exactly what the commission is looking for before the final product of recommendations is out. So right now they've got that first draft up on their website and they're asking everyone, workers, employers, business owners, everybody to take a look at the policies and then leave their comments so that they can use those comments to get their final draft done. That will be done by the next month and then they'll be posted on the human rights website in January 1. And it's not mandated for employers to implement the policies, but strongly encouraged. So you can go to the Human Rights Commission's website, and I'll have a link on mynorthwest.com a little later to give your comments and get a look at those policies. We've also seen the effects at the state legislature overall internally because of the Me Too movement. Both the House and Senate have task force that they created earlier this year to address issues within the legislature after hundreds of women came forward and complained about sexual harassment there. The Senate already came out with its recommendations. The House is supposed to before the end of the year. The state Senate is creating a new department to address those issues there. We have three different lawmakers who are all going to be out of office now because of various sexual allegations against them. All of them deny that. So there's this culture of change going on. Also at the city and county level, at a special meeting last week, the King County Board of Health looked to elevate the conversation around the Me Too movement by looking at the possibility of addressing sexual assault as a public health issue. They heard from several women, including survivors of sexual assault and those that work with survivors, as well as experts who were asked to what the Board of Health could do among the ideas.
How about sustained attention?
I'm going to say ditto and use your voice loudly.
Mandatory sex ed, it just passed in California and some other states. It might be the sort of thing that could be really effective here.
Language access and more money.
We really want to see an intersection between public health and law enforcement.
Increased visibility of the health system and behavioral health system's role in all of this.
So there's a big push nationally, including from the American Medical Association. They just came out with some ideas last week to really find ways to treat sexual assault and harassment as in a public health way. It covers everything from health education, teaching kids about consent, the mental health effect on survivors, to the need to address language barriers, public awareness campaigns, encouraging reporting of sexual assault and harassment, as well as having more forensic nurses who can do rape kits. So every hospital has that ability. The Board of Health will continue working on this in the coming months. Board member Kathy Lambert is hopeful they can make a difference.
I don't think that anybody is going to be more credible than the Board of Health in coming forward and saying this is what the experts in our community think, and the Board of Health is going to stamp that to be able to make it happen, because people are afraid to talk about this subject.
And the city has already made changes. Mayor Durkin, when she came into office, said she was going to look at everything regarding sexual harassment. Of course, we had the big number of complaints coming from against City Light about sexual harassment and a culture of sexual harassment there. Just last week, the City Light had hired its own investigator. That investigator came out with a report last week saying that there was no insufficient evidence to support a culture of sexual harassment within that workplace. But Mayor Durkin has signed an executive order that will create a new office of independent investigation for any department within the city when complaints like this come up.
Well, there are anonymous tip lines now, right? I mean, City's had that for a while. So I assume those calls are coming in and they're not being addressed. Is that the problem?
Well, they're addressed by their own departments, right? City Light hired its own investigator. So now under the Durkin plan, when that's finally implemented, it will have to be this other office that she creates. The agencies will not be allowed to police themselves, in other words.
Yeah, so the anonymous calls were going to somebody in that agency instead of a central agency? Or?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Okay, because I thought I'm trying to figure out what barriers still exist to people who are being harassed and who feel that they obviously can't go public. And so you're telling me there are or are not totally anonymous lines you can call that go to an independent agency that will then handle your complaint without tipping off your boss?
No, absolutely not. The mayor is now creating this independent office.
There has not been such
No, there has not been an independent office. She is now creating that independent office of OMSBED to handle such complaints again, so each department doesn't get to police itself. So that's happening. And King County budget also just included a bunch of money for new training on sexual harassment for King County staffers as well.
So this is going to be sounds like it's going to be a priority in the legislature then?
Yes, absolutely.
For some sort of statewide rule. Now, so far they're talking about voluntary standards, recommendations.
Yes.
Is anybody talking about a mandatory standard?
Nothing that I have seen yet. Again, these came out early in the year in the last session. And the idea was to really just give guidance to employers. Not every business knows what kind of policies they should have. And there's, because of the Me Too movement, more discussion and more clarity on what kind of policies you need to have, how visible you need to make those so you make your staff comfortable.
We've had harassment training here for, I don't know, what, 30 years?
Right.
Now.
And so that was my, right? I've had to do it forever. And it's, I think the general consensus is it's not working.
It's not working, right.
They said in this human rights report that between 25 to 85% of women experience sexual harassment. Now, that's a huge gap. Yeah. And she said part of the reason for that is because so much of it still goes unreported. So that's one of the biggest pushes, is to make sure that you, as a business owner, put that culture out there that welcomes that reporting. Make sure that your staff feels comfortable coming and knowing that you're going to follow through on that complaint process.
Career's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And now here he is from that overstuffed goodie bag of sports, 710 ESPN Seattle, Danny O'Neill. With the Cougs, it's crazy. If this continues, cooging it is going to mean crushing it instead of blowing it, and it'll change the language forever.
You're right, except we got one more to go.
What would that be?
The Apple Cup.
Is that coming up this week?
Yes. Friday,
well, yeah, but
5:30 p.m.
The Cougs are rated way higher than the Huskies.
Yes, they are, and they're favorite in this game. And they're the ones with the shot at the college football playoff, not the Huskies. Mm. And you know what? What's that going to feel like if they can't beat the Huskies this year? If this year, when everything has gone so right, and I see people say, like, we should have even beat USC. We should be undefeated, and they're probably right. But what about in this year if you can't beat Washington?
Well, what are the actual chances if you take off your Husky hat and actually look at the numbers?
Well, I don't know if I can take off my Husky hat because that's my head. I'm capable. No, the Cougs are favored. The Cougs should win this game. The Cougs absolutely should.
Plus, I hear it might snow. That could be a repeat of the old snowball.
Yeah,
huh?
That's Huskies. Huskies don't do well when it snows over
there.
No, that tends to be a bit of a downer. The Cougs have the better team right now. But Washington's gotten two of its better offensive players back. I feel good about their chances. I'm excited. Plus, the idea of being able to rub it in and to turn about and to have all of their joy turn to ash right on their tongue, that would be great.
Which side are you talking about now?
The Cougs.
He's a Husky, so of course he wants to crush the Cougs in the Apple Cup.
I really can't tell which side anybody's on anymore.
Are you serious?
Yeah. So you want the
I've
Huskies?
Failed.
You want the Huskies to win?
Yeah.
And humiliate the Cougs.
Yeah.
You don't question?
You don't think that it would be even more exciting if the perennial underdog Cougs humiliated the Huskies?
No.
But you don't.
No one wants to see Charlie Brown kick the football.
I see.
No one wants to see Charlie Brown finally boot the football.
So do you go?
I want him to get pantsed in front of God and everybody on Sunday. Just absolutely. Boom. There you go.
Do you go to the Apple Cup?
I'm not going this year. I'm going. My family's converging in Yosemite, so I'm going to head down there.
Can you catch the game in Yosemite?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we will be able to.
Wasn't sure how rural it is
out
there.
It's not quite. We're going to Wawona.
Okay.
Which is my favorite name.
Oh, Wawona.
Wawona.
Wow. Are you superstitious? This Redskins quarterback thing?
Yeah.
That's crazy. So on the very same day that
Joe
Theismann had a similar leg break,
like 33
to Alex Smith,
33 years ago,
Washington quarterback,
compound fracture. Theismann's was the worst thing. I didn't need to see Alex Smith's. I had consciously avoided it all day. after I'd heard it happen, I didn't look at any replays, and then I caught it at halftime yesterday, and I felt like I was not warned sufficiently.
They showed it at halftime yesterday?
Yeah.
Why would they show that on TV?
Of the NBC game. That's a very good question. I guess there are some people that would want to see it. I don't need to see that.
No.
It was awful. Yeah, it's horrible. It's so a horrible, horrible
and
injury.
That's the end of his career, then.
That's the end of his season. Theismann was older.
Year older.
Yeah, it's different now, though. Like, you can have, and I'm not sure the full extent of what you could do back then, but I would expect that Alex Smith will be able to come back. He'll probably have a rod inserted. He broke both bones in his lower leg. And I don't know if it was a full compound fracture in the same way.
You really can repair it well enough that you could play football again.
Sure, if you've got a metal rod in your leg.
Earl Thomas did it a couple of years ago.
Really?
That's the injury Earl Thomas is coming back from. I'm not sure if he broke both bones, but he broke the more significant of the two.
What about
bones.
Psychologically, though?
Yes.
Just the idea. I mean, even if they say, yep, you're good to go, everything's just as you're, we made him back. We made him better than he was.
Yeah.
I can't even cut vegetables.
Psychologically, could you? Yeah, that's right.
And I cut just a little piece of my finger off, and I still have a hard time cutting vegetables. I can't imagine playing football.
I know. And it's one of those things of how do you... Dave Wyman is a great example. Dave had a horrible knee injury in college. There was a point where he was in danger of having his leg amputated. It was a dislocation. He tore pretty much everything. His leg pointed the wrong way. It was awful. And he had to come back and find that confidence in your body because, look, these guys, their body's their business. And you have to have faith in it and confidence in it to hold up. Like, you can't, that psychological space where you're like, oh, is this going to happen again? You have to be able to get beyond that. I'm constantly amazed. Mitch Haniger, remember he got hit in the face by a 99 mile an hour fastball. I mean, got hit in face.
And now he has, yeah.
And he goes back and he still is up there. He got buzzed last year where I would think that having a pitch come at your head again after having that happen, the psychological and tough enough to be able to, or being able to get past that psychologically is incredible to me.
So does this open up an opportunity for Colin Kaepernick?
No. It doesn't. And that probably, and this is, we're getting close to the point where I don't even know if it's worth asking anymore because it's very clear that the NFL teams collectively have decided that Kaepernick, for mostly, I think, public relations reasons, is not a tenable employee for them. That the upside that he has as a starting quarterback is not worth the blowback they would get, whether it's from 20% or from 50% of their fans, about how mad people would be in inviting that in. And teams constantly make those calculations. It's usually, though, that they're weighing somebody's criminal conviction or weighing someone's, like, shoddy background. This is someone's political statement that was totally allowed within the NFL guidelines.
And would Kaepernick even accept?
Yeah, that's a great question. I brought that up. Would he want to play for a team whose nickname is a racial epithet?
Probably not.
Well, yeah. That would be a way that the Redskins could inoculate themselves if he decided, okay.
Even then Kaepernick would.
His whole thing is over then.
It'd be interesting to see how that would be taken. Does making an employment decision and going to work for that team, does that change the other stances that you've made? There's lots of people that we consider politically conscious.
Should I go work for Harvey Weinstein?
No.
Right? That would definitely.
But yeah. That's a more personal. That you're right, Colleen.
Colin
that's
Kaepernick will have a job before the day you do that.
But this is a nomenclature thing instead of, but you're right. Those ideas, like, would you be conflicted if you choose your employer that way?
We have the case of the acting attorney general and some of the concerns being raised about him. His name is Matt Whitaker. Some of the FBI rank and file are a little bit worried about what he has said about the Mueller investigation. So we're going to turn to David Gomez, 28-year veteran of the FBI. Prior to retiring from the FBI, he was the senior assistant special agent in charge for the FBI's national security programs here in Seattle. And so, David, tell me, when you see your new boss and read some of his previous quotes, where he basically, at times when he was coming in for CNN, implied that this investigation was a witch hunt, does that affect the rank and file people who are actually running the investigation?
Well, it does in the sense that it sets a tone for the
the politicalization of the Department of Justice, which every FBI agent in the field hates to see. But for the day-to-day agents in Seattle and elsewhere running investigations that are not related to the Mueller probe, it doesn't affect them at all.
I take it you've read some of the objections to Whitaker, some of the things he's said on CNN?
Yes, I have.
Do you find any of those to be at a level that would require him to recuse himself?
Yes, I find them to be very problematic in that it's like having a preconceived opinion about an investigation before you actually know anything about it. At this point, of course, he's been briefed on the investigation. As the acting attorney general, he has the opportunity to read any reports that have been prepared. I don't know, and I don't think anyone knows whether he has already met with Mr. Mueller himself personally to be briefed on the investigation, but it certainly is the kind of thing that if he were a juror in a trial, you would want to exclude him for having preconceived opinions about the guilt or innocence of the defendant.
And some of the statements that he made, for example, June 21st, 2017, he declared that Russia did not collude with Trump's 2016 campaign, even though, of course, the report hadn't been released. He also said that that meeting at Trump Tower, there was nothing extraordinary about it. Any politician would agree to such a meeting. So this leads you to believe that he is predisposed to dismissing these charges?
Exactly. Those are political statements made by a political supporter of the president without any evidence, without a review of any evidence that has been collected. You have a number of people that were at that meeting who have been interviewed, including Donald Trump Jr. Mr. Cohen was not at the meeting. Michael Cohen, the president's former attorney, but was very possibly briefed on what was going on because he was known as a fixer for the president. And he is now cooperating with the Mueller investigation. So it's, of course, at that time that he made those statements, he was not, in the running to be the attorney general or the assistant attorney general, acting attorney general. I believe he was, it was even prior to him being appointed as the chief of staff to Mr. Sessions, the former attorney general.
Whitaker is also on record as being against any investigation into Donald Trump's finances, which, of course, is the president's own red line. As an investigator, and from what you know of this investigation, would, for example, his tax returns be germane to this investigation?
Well, I don't know that they'd be germane to this investigation, but there's a completely separate investigation that's going on in the Southern District of New York involving Michael Cohen. And financial dealings in New York that is not related to the Mueller investigation, which has very very specific limits. I think that Mueller has asked some questions about Mr. Trump's finances, and that's what's causing a lot of angst within the White House, and the idea that they should be completely separate. But within the federal system, when you have investigations in one district that. And information is gathered, evidence is gathered. It can be, passed along to other investigators in other districts, which would include the Mueller investigation.
So those returns might come out. Well, bottom line, do you think that Congress needs to pass some sort of legislation protecting the investigation?
I would certainly like to see that on a personal basis, but I don't think that it's absolutely necessary because I think that there would be a very strong backlash to anything happening. And the other thing that people need to remember is that this investigation, we're so far along in the investigation that it's not going to go away if you get rid of Mr. Mueller. And I don't think they're going to be able to stop the actual investigation from moving forward. You can get rid of Bob Mueller, but you can't stop that investigation from moving forward with the indictments they already have and the potential for sealed indictments, which is the other foot that we're waiting to drop this week or next week.
Retired FBI Special Agent David Gomez. David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And joining us now, CBS Senior Money Editor Jill Schlesinger. Holiday shopping season is already here, and this is going to be even bigger than last year?
Yeah, it looks like it. I mean, this is a combination of stronger U.S. economic growth and certainly that unemployment at that 49-year low. It's put consumers in a pretty good mood. And according to a lot of recent surveys, they say they're going to spend more money, maybe up by, you know, anywhere between 4% and 6% from a year ago. That'll bring us above, this number is crazy, $1.1 trillion on the holidays. So it does look like this could be, because we don't know yet, could be the biggest holiday season yet.
Now, is this being pushed just by Amazon, or are there other people jumping into that space too?
You know, it's always amazing to me because, of course, we know that online sales are growing faster. You know, by some accounts, 15% to 20% will be ahead of last year. So, you know, e-commerce sales probably growing by double digits again. And obviously, brick and mortar not growing as much. However, it's still amazing. The lion's share of overall holiday receipts take place in a physical location, about 88%.
Still, huh?
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
So what is it that's driving this big increase then?
Well, I think what's driving the increase in general is that when we see people who have jobs and feel good, they're going to spend more money. What's amazing to me is that we are now moving into a new phase. It used to be we would say I'm either an online shopper or I'm a physical shopper. But, you know, retailers, they kind of got fat, dumb, and happy for a little while. The in-store experience was kind of nasty. Now they're being smarter. Come into our store. We'll give you a great experience, right? You know, have a cup of coffee, chill out, or we'll do something different. We'll let you experience. We'll let you go into a freezing cold room with your new parka on to see how warm it is. And you know what? It's working. People are basically conducting their research online. Right?
Yeah.
And then they are going into some of these physical stores and buying in the store. And that looks like it's really the most interesting trend, a blended approach to the retail experience.
So brick and mortar isn't washed up, but they have to try harder.
They sure do. And they've got to deliver something. I was talking to a guy who owns an independent bookstore. And he said something really interesting. He's like, look, I cannot compete with Amazon. I cannot carry that many books. But what I can do is I can have a staff that's actually better than an algorithm, a staff person who can talk to somebody and say, oh, well, you know, you really liked reading this very interesting book called Capital by Thomas Piketty. So you must like a lot of analysis of economics. And gee, why don't you try this one called Crashed by this guy? You know, so having a curated experience. And also, you know, I think that there is a sense that people do like the community feel of a local brick and mortar location when it's an independent store. That certainly works. And people do still want to touch and feel a product. But, yeah. You know, it's more important that you get them there with something that's different than the online experience.
You know what also has survived is small town hardware stores, which I've always loved. But you can buy all that stuff cheaper online. But what I don't need is the stuff so much as someone who can tell me, first of all, what I need, and then how to use it.
Well, that's exactly right. That expertise becomes very important. And what we're starting to see is that people are willing to pay for that. And, you know, I think what's great about technology is that you can absolutely really do a ton of research, but you may go to that hardware store and they have something completely different. And it kind of picks your head up and you say, oh, okay, well, I did my research, but I'm going to an expert now.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS News Senior Business Analyst. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.